Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome everyone to The Deep Dive. I'm your host.
And I'm your analyst.
Today, we're really digging into something fundamental, something that shapes our world constantly, even when we don't see it. We're talking about diplomacy.
That's right. We're drawing heavily on the work of Joseph M. Siracusa. He's a really distinguished scholar who spent his career unpacking how nations actually talk to each other.
And maybe, more importantly, how they avoid not talking, how they manage to survive disputes.
Yeah, and it's such a critical topic right now because, honestly, the whole game seems to be changing so fast.
Totally. I mean, think about it. You go from these ancient messengers, you know, carrying scrolls.
Right, or super secret envoys meeting in castles.
It's things like diplomacy happening on Twitter.
Yeah.
And then you throw in cyber warfare, these massive global corporations. It's a different landscape.
Which brings us to the core question Siracusa's work makes us ask and makes you, our listener, think about.
Is the traditional diplomat, that figure we sort of picture, are they becoming obsolete in this age of instant everything? Do we still need them?
Or is their role just evolving as a real challenge to the old ways?
Before we get into the history, though, there's one really big misconception we need to clear up. Something Siracusa points out again and again.
Ah, yes. The classic mix-up. Diplomacy versus foreign policy. People use them interchangeably all the time.
So let's nail this down right at the start. What is the difference?
Okay, simply put, diplomacy is not foreign policy. Think of foreign policy as the what. It's the goal, the grand strategy, what a nation actually wants to achieve on the world stage.
Right, the objective.
Exactly. Diplomacy, though, that's the how. It's the engine, the process, the actual toolkit you use to get there. Negotiation, communication, representation,
yeah.
All that skillful work.
Okay, so foreign policy is the blueprint, the plan. Diplomacy is the plan. The construction crew, the engineers actually building the bridge.
That's a great way to put it. Without that skilled diplomatic engine, the best foreign policy is just, well, an idea sitting on a shelf. It doesn't go anywhere.
It's stuck in the garage, as you said before.
Precisely. Diplomacy is that complex, often really patient mechanism that turns national ambitions into international reality, or tries to, anyway.
So who is this expert guiding us? Joseph M. Siracusa. Tell us a bit more about him. Someone who can make that distinction so clearly must have quite the background.
He really does. He's a distinguished professor, specialized in history and diplomacy. He's particularly known for his work on the Cold War, which was, I mean, talk about high-stakes diplomacy.
Right, nuclear negotiations, brinksmanship.
Exactly. He's written a huge amount on U.S. foreign policy, crisis management, how leaders navigate those really intense moments.
And what makes his take so valuable for us for this deep dive?
I think it's his ability to zoom out and see the long view, as you put it. He connects the dots across centuries, looking for patterns in how humans handle conflict and cooperation.
But he's not just an academic, right?
No, and that's key. He's consulted with governments. He's observed international bodies up close. So he brings this dual perspective.
Okay, so deep historical knowledge combined with a real practical sort of nuts and bolts understanding of how these negotiations actually work, how deals get done or fall apart in the real world.
That's the blend. He gets the theory and the practice, the history and the pressure of the moment.
Perfect. Okay, let's get to the core of his argument then. What's the central thesis we should keep in mind as we go through this?
At its heart, Siracusa's argument is actually quite straightforward, but incredibly powerful. It's that diplomacy is fundamentally humanity's most essential tool.
Tool for what?
For managing how countries interact, for preventing conflicts from spiraling out of control, and ideally for fostering cooperation. Its basic job being the main alternative to war, finding peaceful ways through disputes, that hasn't changed.
Even with all the tech and Twitter and everything.
Even with all that. The fundamental purpose remains constant, he argues, despite these massive shifts in technology and who holds power.
So it's way more than just like formal protocols and state dinners.
Oh, absolutely. He sees it as a really sophisticated craft. It demands deep cultural understanding, sharp strategic thinking, and just exceptional communication skills.
The patient work behind the scenes.
Exactly. It's the constant effort to build and maintain those off-ramps when disagreements flare up. It's global relationship management, really. Continuous, often invisible work.
Okay, foundation laid. Let's trace that evolution. You mentioned a surprising origin story for modern diplomacy. not the big empires.
Yeah, this is where it gets really fascinating. Syracuse points out that modern diplomacy, the system we basically still use, didn't emerge from Rome or China or some huge empire.
Where then?
It came from the Italian city-states in the 15th century. Venice, Florence, Milan, places like that.
Wait, really? Small city-states, why them?
Because they were locked in constant, intense rivalry. They were neighbors, always competing, sometimes fighting. This meant they needed continuous intelligence. They needed ongoing negotiation, not just sending a messenger occasionally.
Ah, so the sheer proximity and competition forced their hand.
Precisely. They couldn't afford to wait months for news. This necessity led them to invent the resident ambassador, a permanent representative living in the other state's capital.
Permanent presence.
Yes. And that's the key insight, continuous relationship maintenance. It's far more effective than just reacting to crises when they happen. The Venetians, especially, perfected this. Their system became the blueprint.
Okay, so that system evolves. We get what's called the old diplomacy, right? Kicked off properly by the Peace of Westphalia.
That's the next big phase. The old diplomacy, think 17th century up to the early 20th. It was very European, very aristocratic, very secretive. Cabinet diplomacy, they called it. Conducted behind closed door.
And its main goal was?
Maintaining the balance of power. That was the absolute driving principle.
What does that actually mean, though? Balance of power?
It basically means making sure no single country or alliance gets too strong. You counter potential threats by forming alliances of your own. It relies on a kind of mutual suspicion, actually. Oh. Think of the Congress of Vienna after Napoleon trying to redraw the map to keep everyone sort of balanced and checked. It was pragmatic, maybe cynical, but focused entirely on stability through these counterweights.
But then World War I happens.
Yeah.
And that whole system just spectacularly fails.
Early. And that catastrophe triggers this huge backlash, this intellectual revolution led by figures like Woodrow Wilson.
On the new diplomacy.
Exactly. Wilson basically said, this secret balance of power stuff doesn't work. It caused the war. He called for open covenants openly arrived at. No more secret deals.
And he championed collective security.
Yes, through things like the League of Nations.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that nations should band together to guarantee each other's security, relying on shared rules and institutions rather than just shifting alliances.
So it's a move from relying on mutual distrust
to relying on mutual trust and commitment. It's a massive shift in thinking.
And that tension between the pragmatic old diplomacy and the idealistic new diplomacy.
It's still completely central to foreign policy debates today. Do you focus on hard power and national interest or on international law and cooperation?
Okay, fast forward again. Mid-20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Nuclear weapons enter the picture. That must have changed everything for diplomats.
Oh, absolutely. Suddenly, the stakes weren't just war, they were potential annihilation. Diplomacy had to adapt incredibly quickly.
And Syracuse points to one event as the ultimate test case here, right? The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962.
That's the crucible. It's the prime example of what he calls coercive diplomacy.
Coercive diplomacy sounds intense.
It is. It's the careful, calculated use of threats, often military threats, or signaling military readiness to persuade your opponent to back down or change their behavior. But crucially, it's managed threat. Meaning it's not just about issuing ultimatums, it's about signaling resolve, making the threat credible, but also simultaneously providing a way out for the other side, a face-saving exit, an off-ramp.
You have to give them somewhere to go other than escalation.
Precisely. And during the crisis, this was managed through incredibly critical communication channels, some formal, some very informal back channels. It proved that even when you're on the brink, keeping that line open is the absolute top priority for a diplomat.
So even in that extreme pressure cooker, the basics, Syracuse talks about communication, finding exits they still held.
They became even more critical. But that patience, that careful signaling, now jump to the 21st century. Diplomacy faces a whole new set of challenges.
Globalization, for one. Everything's connected.
Right. And non-state actors are huge now. Terrorist groups, massive multinational corporations with budgets bigger than some countries.
They weren't really factors in the old diplomacy system.
Not in the same way. Plus, you have these transnational threats, climate change, pandemics, cybersecurity, that no single nation can handle alone.
So the diplomat's job description has just exploded.
Completely. You need to be agile, tech savvy. You need to understand public diplomacy, talking directly to foreign populations, not just governments. And yeah, you get things like diplomacy.
But doesn't that speed, the instant nature of platforms like Twitter, undermine the careful deliberation Syracuse says is so important? Can patience survive going viral?
That's the tension, isn't it? Syracuse acknowledges this. The tools change, the speed increases, the pressure mounts. The diplomat today has to manage the immediate public communication while also doing the slow, painstaking work of building trust and understanding behind the scenes.
It's a juggling act. Okay, that sweep through history is really helpful. Let's pull out some of those big, overarching themes, lessons that maybe apply beyond just international relations.
Definitely. The first one that really stands out is continuity amid change.
Which feels like what we were just talking about. The tools change scrolls to tweets, but the core job.
The core human need remains the same. The need to communicate across differences, to find ways to resolve disputes without violence. Syracuse shows how the fundamental patterns of interaction, the need for trust, for clear signaling, these things persist.
So the past still offers real guidance. The basic skills are timeless.
Exactly. Whether you're an ambassador in 15th century Venice or managing a global crisis call today, things like consistency, reliability, understanding your counterpart, those are still the foundations.
Okay, theme two seems to dive deeper into that human element.
Mm-hmm.
Cultural understanding as a diplomatic foundation.
Yeah, this comes up again and again in his historical examples. So many diplomatic failures boil down to cultural misunderstandings, misinterpretations, or just plain insensitivity.
Forgetting who you're talking to.
Right. Success often hinges on the ability to bridge those cultural gaps, to show respect, to understand the other side's perspective, their history, their red lines. It's not just strategy, it's empathy.
And that's true everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, think about working in a diverse team or negotiating with someone from a different background. That same need for empathy and, frankly, doing your homework about their perspective is crucial.
Absolutely. It translates directly. Now, the third theme is about something we often don't even notice.
About that.
Diplomacy as conflict prevention. Syracuse argues its most vital contribution is often the stuff that doesn't make headlines.
The crises that don't happen.
Exactly. The patient, persistent work of maintaining communication channels, building relationships, managing small disagreements before they can escalate. It's the preventative maintenance of the international system.
The invisible work. That makes sense. It's hard to celebrate something that didn't occur.
Right. But that's often where diplomacy is most successful.
Okay, let's talk about some specific ideas or quotes that really capture the essence of this craft. Syracuse seems to have a knack for summing things up.
He does. These aren't necessarily direct quotes, but key ideas that encapsulate his thinking.
Okay, hit me with the first one, something about the psychology of it.
Yeah, this one's great. Diplomacy is the art of letting someone else have your way.
Huh. Okay, unpack that. It sounds a bit manipulative.
Well, maybe, but think about it in terms of negotiation. It's about finding solutions where the other party feels like they've won, like no needs have been met, even if the outcome achieves your core objective.
So it's about framing, about understanding what they need to hear, what constitutes a win for them.
Exactly. Addressing their underlying interests so they can accept the deal, maybe even champion it. It allows everyone to save face and claim some success. Very skillful.
Okay, second idea. This one touches on technology.
Right. Technology changes the speed and scope of diplomacy, but not its fundamental nature as a human activity requiring trust, understanding, and patience.
That reinforces a continuity theme. Tech is a tool, not a replacement for human skill.
Precisely. Email, video calls, social media, they change how you interact, how fast things move, but they don't build trust on their own. That still requires human connection, consistency, reliability.
The core skills remain paramount. Okay, last one. Focuses on communication.
Yes. The diplomat's greatest skill is not in knowing what to say, but in understanding what others need to hear.
Ooh, that's sharp. It's about empathy again, isn't it? Audience awareness.
Completely. You have to understand your counterpart's position, their constraints, their cultural context, what arguments will actually resonate with them, not just what sounds good to you or your side. If you only talk about what you want, you're likely to fail.
You need to tailor the message. Okay, these are powerful ideas. Let's bring it home for the listener. How can we apply these diplomatic principles in our own lives, maybe professionally?
Well, think about that idea of coercive diplomacy, managing pressure. You might not have nuclear missiles, but maybe you're in a tough negotiation at work or dealing with a really difficult stakeholder.
Okay.
The principle is the same. You need to be firm, signal your resolve, make your case strongly, but you also need to consciously think about providing an off-ramp for the other person, a way for them to agree or shift their position without looking weak or losing face.
So don't just corner them. Always leave a dignified way out. That requires thinking ahead.
Definitely. And what about that idea of letting them have your way? That links directly to negotiation skills.
How so?
Diplomats are trained to look beyond the surface, demands the stated positions, and try to understand the underlying interests. What does the other side really need?
Ah, like if someone demands a bigger budget.
Their stated position.
Their underlying interest might actually be about retaining key staff or getting better software or feeling valued.
Exactly. And if you can figure out that underlying interest, you might be able to propose a different solution, maybe targeted bonuses or a specific tech investment that meets their real need without necessarily just giving them the budget number they first asked for.
That's much more creative. It's problem solving, not just haggling.
It is. And finally, that emphasis on relationship management and keeping channels open.
Yeah.
Think about personal conflicts or disagreements in the workplace. Diplomatic practice shows the worst thing you can do when things get tense is to cut off communication entirely. Shutting down makes resolution almost impossible. Even maintaining minimal low-level contact keeps the door open for things to eventually improve. Consistency, reliability, being seen as someone who doesn't just disappear when things get tough, that builds capital over time.
Maintain the connection, even if it's strained. Those are really practical takeaways. Okay, final thoughts. What's the one thing that really stands out to you from digging into Syracuse's work on diplomacy?
For me, it's probably the sheer resilience and adaptability of it all. That basic model, born out of necessity between rival Italian cities centuries ago.
The resident ambassador.
Yeah. That it could evolve and morph and somehow still be the fundamental basis for how we manage incredibly complex global issues today, from nuclear treaties to digital trade agreements. It's kind of amazing. It just hammers home that adaptation is everything for diplomacy and probably for us too.
That's a great point. The evolution itself is the story. For me, connecting it to the bigger picture, the most powerful lesson is maybe a bit more philosophical. It's that diplomacy, at its best, doesn't actually eliminate disagreements or conflicts of interest.
Because those are inevitable, right? Part of life.
Exactly. What diplomacy does is provide the structures, the processes, the skills, the sophisticated mechanisms for managing those conflicts constructively over the long haul. It's not about finding perfect harmony.
It's about managing unavoidable friction.
Yeah, it's this ongoing iterative process. And honestly, the fact that humans develop this and keep trying to refine it, even imperfectly. Well, Syracuse suggests the practice offers maybe the best hope we have for navigating a complex future together. It's a process worth investing in.
A crucial ongoing human endeavor.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accatra Foundation.